Greetings, everybody. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, good. Okay. Let's just take a few more seconds to let people in and just settle wherever we are. And as always, let's just take a moment to appreciate this remarkable tradition that we have, that we share, that we're exploring now, this Mahamudra tradition that has been brought to life and made possible for us to enjoy through the kindness of countless men and women throughout the ages, all the way back to the time of the Buddha. It's almost unbelievable that these teachings come to us in a way that is completely intact, completely available, completely authentic, and offered to us by realized teachers. It's one of the few real bright spots in our world these days. Now let's just for 1 minute just allow mind to rest openly. Without forcing anything, with no contrivance, just rest openly, just for a minute. Okay. It always comes to my mind when we practice like this, when we practice non-meditation, an experience that's not fabricated, and one that we are not distracted from, that there's so much to say and so little to say. This is the paradox of exploring Mahamudra. There's so much to say. It's such a beautiful and rich tradition. And yet, when we actually get down to it, there's so little to say. There's so little to do. That's the paradox. That's the beauty of this tradition. That once and for all, finally, in our lives, writ large, and also in terms of our life on the path. Finally, we can simply be. We can simply let be, however it is. This is freedom. This is relief from struggle, from yearning, from longing, from pushing, from hoping, from fearing. We can just let be. We can afford to let be. Because when we let be, finally, we have an opportunity to experience our basic nature. We are rich with this basic nature. And having forgotten it, and just out of habit, we're chasing around frantically, trying to find something that we think is potentially, it is possible. We're frantic trying to find a new way of being, a way of being that's more relaxed and open and connected and natural. We intuit that this is possible. Otherwise, we wouldn't try. If this wasn't our basic nature, this basic sense of fullness, of naturalness, of ease, of natural warmth, natural connection, if that wasn't our basic nature, we wouldn't know to look for it, having lost it. From this point of view, our struggle is proof of our basic abiding nature. This is so simple. It's so elegant. It's so obviously true. And yet we even can't imagine that. We can't imagine that that's possible. I always think of the story of the Buddha that you've heard so many times, that after so many years of struggle, after he left the palace and worked and worked and worked and did this and that and followed this tradition and that tradition, and then finally, not knowing what else to do, he starved his body. And he realized, this isn't it. And as the life story of the Buddha says, that he sat under the rose apple tree and he looked out and had a memory of a childhood memory of being in his father's fields and just playing, carefree. And he realized, this is what I'm missing. And as the legend says, then he went and sat under the Bodhi tree and said, I will not leave until I found what I'm looking for. This is a little bit like us. This is a little bit like us coming to Mahamudra, where after years and years and years of study and practice and striving and all of this, we can finally just give it up and rest naturally. This is the tradition of Mahamudra. This is why it's so beloved. This is why it's so completely appropriate for this time, for our lives. Because finally, we can take up our inheritance. It's so beautiful. So actually, I didn't mean to say any of that. I got completely carried away. So I will have, as usual, a few comments. So I think on paper, on internet paper, as it were, we are just now at the end of our essence course. So the last two sections of the essence course are called experience and realization and the life of a Mahamudra meditator. So I think I'll just make a couple of comments about this, because these two points are so critical for us. Because as we move along the path, we have experiences. And it's one of the difficult things about practicing along the path by ourselves, without Dharma friends, without teachers, without guides, without spiritual friends, without community. It's one of the difficult things, because a lot of experience happens along the path. We need to know what to do with all of that. Of course, some of the experiences are wonderful and some of them are rough, what we call rough experiences. And we have all had them. Of course, in any endeavor, if we put our energy and our time and our mind to it, just by the cause and effect, if we do something, something will result. If we come back again and again and again to an authentic method of taming, clarifying, purifying, and opening mind, then that will come to pass. But along the process, as we open up, it's kind of like opening up an old storeroom in our house or our grandmother's house or our great-grandmother's house. You never know what the hell's in there. Some of it will delight us and some of it will kind of freak us out. So as you know, and the reason I just want to just sort of highlight what you've already learned and what many of you have known for many years. And as usual, part of the reason part of the reason why it's good to talk about these things, so that we can get them, we can remember what we remember in our head, so that we can then talk to ourselves when things come up along the path, and then also talk with others about the path. So as you know, there's three classic favorable, pleasant experiences. These are what we refer to as three nyam, N-Y-A-M in Tibetan. And they just mean meditation experience. So the first, in no particular order, but generally, the first is this, just when a kind of deep sense of well-being comes to us for whatever reason. It's just sort of just things, it just feels good. We feel good. And this is classically referred to as bliss. Bliss here doesn't mean sometimes, and this doesn't mean an ecstatic experience, as sometimes is talked about in the Hindu tradition. This just is a sort of a, just a sort of an unreasonable sense of well-being for no particular reason. This is bliss. The second is that mind may just, that this thought activity in mind may just stop and open up for a period of time. And that's sometimes referred to as the third. The middle one, the second one, is called clarity. So Mingyur Rinpoche uses the word clarity in a lot of ways. Generally, clarity just means knowing. In this sense of this positive meditation experience, this kind of clarity is a sort of sharpness. So it's lovely. Bliss, clarity, non-thought. Also, it's not uncommon at all for whatever reason to experience just a profound sense of connection and compassion with others, a kind of sense of oneness with the world and with others. This is beautiful. Along with that, a profound sense of appreciation and trust in all those men and women who made this possible for us. So these are the positive experiences. Then we have rough experiences. Now, the classic rough experiences are what we call dullness and agitation, and you know about that. These are the classic meditation rough experiences. But also, it's completely common for us to have really rough experiences in our life, particularly in the beginning. It's not uncommon at all for people to report that, you know, they started meditating and within months, you know, all sorts of obstacles and difficulties came up. This is completely natural, and it's a good sign. It's a good sign. It means that our habitual mind, our karmic mind, is beginning to open up and things are beginning to happen. So up is lovely. Down is particularly good, because down shows that things are moving, and it brings a sort of, it brings us to bring greater endeavor to what we're doing. In fact, I can remember talking with His Holiness Dogo Kensi Rinpoche about these things. I can't remember whether we were talking, or it was part of a teaching that he gave, but it was a discussion we had, and he was talking about these positive experiences as being positive obstacles, that we have these experiences and then we grab onto them and we want to repeat those experiences. And in doing so, what we've just done in a nanosecond is we brought hope and fear into our meditation life. He said, that's even worse. This is what we refer to as positive obstacles. So the whole, and then when things are rough, it means that as Mingyur Rinpoche says, what it means is that things are begin, our patterning is beginning to become apparent to us. That mind and our patterns are beginning to separate. This is really a helpful point, that mind and our patterns are beginning to separate. And this is purification. That mind, the patterns are beginning to sort of be drawn out, and mind itself is becoming purified. So what happens what happens so often at this point is that when mind and its patterns are interwoven, are indistinguishable like this, what happens is we perceive the world through that patterned mind or that patterned lens, you could say. And then the whole world becomes that pattern. If our karmic pattern, for instance, is aggression, it would be like putting on glasses with a red tinted glass and looking out, and the whole world looks red. The whole world looks threatening. And so that we respond to that as if it was threatening, and we create a kind of karmic loop where we perceive an agitated world, a threatening world, we receive it, respond to that agitated world. And then interestingly enough, and we know this in our relations, for instance, that what happens is then the world responds to us in like manner, and we create this loop of whatever the pattern is. It could be passion, it could be aggression, it could be pride or jealousy or ignorance or whatever. And we go around and around like this. But when we begin to meditate and these patterns become clear to us, actually we have an opportunity finally to make a distinction between how is my patterned perception and how is the world. This is the beginning of freedom. It's incredibly uncomfortable. It's incredibly uncomfortable. It can be very disturbing because we realize our whole life has been tainted by our patterned mind. And when this goes on, actually, when our awareness and our patterns become distinct, we begin to see things that we hadn't seen before. And often, I think Mingyur Rinpoche used the example. Often there is an example, for instance, if you go to a mountain lake and there's this wind on the surface of the lake, you can't see into the lake. But if the wind settles down, the surface settles down, all of a sudden we can see into the lake. And what do we see? We see old logs and old, you know, boat motors and, you know, all this old stuff in the lake. This is how we begin to see ourselves. We begin to see this patterning. It's really critical to talk about these things because at home we have these experiences and we can't understand why. So this is the way the path goes. It goes up, the path goes down. What I find often, you know, when talking with a lot of people, and in my own case, in the beginning, the path was very, very strong in the first sort of months. Everything seems to open up. This is one of the reasons, by the way, when you have programs of meditation, maybe a meditation training that's three months long, for instance, it's quite a wonderful experience because you're on that first sort of rise. And then what happens often is the path goes underground. We don't see it. It starts working in our system way deep down inside. So it can kind of go to, we can't find it. Sometimes we experience it as a lot of difficulty because our life, our karmic life is opening up. And our patterns are beginning to come clear. So the path goes up, path goes down, up and down. As you've heard, the wonderful metaphor of going from Eastern Tibet to Central Tibet. If you're a tradesman, a trader going from Eastern Tibet and trading whatever they, yak butter, yak fur, yak tents, yak meat, whatever they have, to go to Lhasa, the capital, to trade, the path goes up one mountain range, down another, and up another, and down another. And this is the way the journey goes. This is the way our path, up and down and up and down, but all the while we're getting closer to the capital. This is really important. And then often what happens, particularly farther down, you know, sort of quite a ways down the road, In the beginning, our experience has what Mingu Rinpoche calls a lot of flavor. A lot of things will happen. It'll have, oh, that was wonderful. Oh, that was a good meditation. Oh, I feel so compassionate today. Oh, I feel so clear today. On and on and on. There's a lot of flavor in the path. At some point, that flavor will go away. And again, the reason it's so helpful to have a chance to talk about these things is because when the flavor goes away, it's very easy for someone to say, oh, meditation no longer works for me. I better try some psilocybin or something. And the reason what's going on when that flavor goes away is that what has happened is, you know, for instance, what it means is like we'll sit down to meditate, we'll open our eyes, and there's just like nothing. There's just like, this is nothing. There's no big deal here. Why am I sitting here? This is stupid. Nothing is going on. And the reason there's no flavor is because our mind and our whole mind stream and meditation have equalized. Our mind has become stable. It has become tamed. So there's nowhere to go. There's no way to really judge. Again, this is important to talk about because at this point, it's common for someone to say this meditation thing has stopped working. Nothing could be further from the truth. This is a great sign. There is a beautiful line in the tradition that says, in the beginning, the meditator chases meditation. And in the end, meditation chases the meditator. So at this point, our whole life, sort of mind just becomes naturally meditative, naturally resting in its nature, naturally tamed. So I had so much more interesting stuff to talk about, but I don't want to talk about it because I want to hear from you. But I will share one last thing that you've heard me say before, but this is such wonderful advice for meditators. And I don't know, you know, this particular course is coming to an end, and I don't know, you know, maybe someone's here for the last time or not. I don't know. But we talk so much about judging our meditation, and everybody will have a different sort of take on, you know, how to judge our meditation. And in modern times, it's common for us because we're very sort of, how can I say, materialistic people. We figure, well, I've put 5 hours into it in the last month. Did I get 5 hours worth back? And so we're looking, and sometimes even teachers will say, you know, each day, judge your mind. So I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that actually that as practitioners, real yogins, we shouldn't judge our mind. We should judge our aspiration, because everything arises from aspiration. Nothing else is important. This is what Mingyur Rinpoche refers to as 0% meditation. In other words, we sit down on a cushion, not because what we've been experiencing or what is promised, but simply what we aspire to. And finally, someone, I was talking about this not too long ago with someone, and they said that they had heard the Dalai Lama. Someone had asked the Dalai Lama about judging their meditation. And the Dalai Lama said, well, if you have to judge your meditation, judge it every 10 years. So I can remember going to Mingyur Rinpoche's father once in my typical, up the mountain, to see the Lama, and walked in, and I had a lot to complain about as usual. And, I was in this particular moment, rather than complaining about the Sangha or my relationships or the state of the world, I decided to complain about my meditation practice. And I said, you know, I can't do this and I can't do that. My meditation isn't like this and it's not like that. And he was very abruptly stopped me, which sort of etched this experience into my mind, because he was a very gentle person. He said, please don't take that attitude. And he said, just taking 7 steps towards your meditation cushion with the aspiration to tame your mind, open your heart, to benefit oneself and others. He said, that is what makes your life meaningful. And then he said, get on the cushion and do whatever technique you do on the cushion, then get off and then leave it. This is incredibly helpful for me. Okay. Let's open it up now. Anybody, questions, comments, particularly those who we haven't heard from before? Just as a last note, I think that we're moving on to a new course now at the end of November. Sorry, at the end of October. And some will be staying on for the immersion, for the Ganges Mahamudra immersion course. Some will be going to the Nectar of the Path course, which, if I do say so myself, it was one of the first courses that I designed, with, you know, the gang. And it's fabulous. So the practice is wonderful and the course is really, really good. So, Elaine.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. What you're talking about, the separation of mind and patterns, that seems really to resonate exactly with what's been on my mind. But the way that I'm experiencing it, this separation, it seems to be that, you know, what's agitating or disturbing my mind is that I feel like I'm reaching a sense of this inner transformation, you know, really feeling this on a deeper level. And then what's happening to me to interrupt it is that I'm finding that people that I know that are not that are part of my regular life, that are not necessarily part of the sanghas that I attend, are not changing accordingly, you know. So the separation between mind and pattern, I suppose from what you're saying that what I'm experiencing then is a projection somehow. That I'm not somehow recognizing the pattern that I'm seeing the pattern emerge from their behavior, and you know that's upsetting me, that it's disturbing me. So I'm not quite sure how to deal with that.
Tolkuchin also at one point said, "If we see faults in others, it is our own problem." So. There's no question about it. When our patterning begins to change, that sometimes what we used to find interesting or attractive, we no longer find interesting and attractive. So this is our shift, not a shift. This is not a failing in the world. This is a shift in us. So I often hear from people, and many of us have had this experience, that I changed my profession when I started meditating. And you know, some of what I found attractive previously, I no longer found attractive. This can be a little bit of a wild ride, particularly in the beginning. But it is the ultimate insult that people don't care about your mind or your meditation or your transformation. They will continue to be the way they are. And it may be some years before you come back to the point that actually they're perfect. They've always been perfect. And we were the fly in the ointment. This is called pure view. This is where this goes. That we see those people, that we have compassion for their irritating expression and we have devotion for their perfect nature. And then we're free. But go ahead, Elaine, what else?
You're reading Naropa's wisdom when he talks about that transformation. I was looking for the exact part, but I mean, some of the responses that he has, you know, one of them, kind of the option that he brings up is solitude, you know, going to solitary meditation. So I take it then that what you're saying is like the solitude is not necessarily the path, but it's kind of like just hanging in for the ride, and eventually.
Solitude retreat is infinitely important for a lot of reasons. But I think personally, the main reason is that we actually have an opportunity for the first time in our life to go cold turkey. That until then, until we actually go into retreat, we will never have known ourselves in the first person. We only know ourselves as an echo from the world, even from birth. An infant learns who they are from their mother, and then from their play group, and then from their school group, then from their relationships, their professional relationships. We have actually no immediate experience of who we are. It's not until we go into retreat, literally close the door, that we can finally come face to face with who we are. It's incredibly important. And we do that so that we can move further along the path, develop greater clarity, greater wisdom, and with that, greater compassion. So that's why we go into retreat, so that we can actually become closer to people, not farther away from people. Yeah. Retreat is infinitely important.
Okay. Thank you. I see other people have questions.
We have a retreat course on Vajrayana online that we may feature before long. It's on retreat. And of the many courses we have, it's a short course. It's actually one of my very favorites because I have a lot of passion for retreat, but it's really lovely. Yeah. Jin-san.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi. Can you hear me or see me?
Yeah.
Sorry. I know I'm somebody who comes up more often than others. So I just two things. What Rinpoche Tukul Rinpoche just taught, and I zoomed in various monasteries in New York State. And what you were saying about Mom Mudra, I don't see you, Tim. I'm seeing somebody else, but Elaine, I'm seeing Elaine. Okay. So what you said about the Mom Mudra after all these years, finally being able to let go of, you know, all the different, whatever, you know, complicated stuff and come to just Mom Mudra. He said, and this was for me very profound. He said, the idea is that I am not practicing the Dharma. I am my practice.
Wow.
I wrote that down. To me, that was it. You know, it's not about I'm doing this, I'm doing that to, you know, verify or confirm that I'm practicing the Dharma through all the different, but I am the practice. I am my practice. So I found
that's
that
beautiful.
To be very,
I wanted
to share that. And then just the other thing is when we talk about solitude, another time long ago with I like you, your reasoning for doing retreat and just whatever you said, that first thing you said about just not being able to, you know, look at your phone or anything to distract you. That was like spot on. But one time someone said about the term solitude, it's like in the old days, you go off to the top of the mountain and, you know, that was the solitude. But now the solitude is actually just allowing the space, or it's referring to the space between being aware of our thought and the reaction to our thought. So being able to have that spaciousness that then says, oh, that's, instead of going, that's a thought of anger, to, you know, or I'm angry, to being able to step back and having that space to go, oh, that's a thought about anger. I just thought that was helpful.
Yeah. So sometimes we talk about outer and inner retreat.
Oh, there you go. That's what it is.
So that's the inner retreat. So the outer retreat is actually changing our circumstance. And the important thing, and you know this well, Jin-san, the critical thing, it's critical that we don't confuse these. Because then other people will say, oh, I'm always on retreat. Or they'll come up with some fancy language to avoid just the hard reality that we need to make it happen. I mean, you don't need to. There's no law about this. But as you know, I can remember back in the day, we used to say that our daily practice will bring the pot of water, will bring it to boil, but only in retreat will it really boil. So we don't want to be absolutist, but here retreat could literally mean, turning off your phone and closing the door for 24 hours. Sometimes that shift, that first moments of retreat, often those can be as profound as going off for months and years. Because if we go off for months and years, which is wonderful, that can become habitual, a habitual way of life. And then we bring our habituated patterns into that. So just, you know, doing a weekend, just closing the door and making an agreement with your friends or partner or whatever that I'm unavailable for the next 24 hours. That can be profound. In the same way that if we're at a rock concert and then all of a sudden everything stops, the silence is remarkable. It's the contrast that's so helpful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Lisa.
Good morning, everyone. I also speak up too much, so my apologies. But Tim, something came up that I'm quite interested in. You talk about this up and down, and I practice with my husband, so we're always practicing together. We're together 24/7. And what we've found recently is that things have come up jointly. We're both going through this stuff, so much so that we're in counseling right now. It's kind of funny, but we're going through this, and do you find this with couples as well, that all of a sudden they start to, because you're so connected, right? And all of a sudden as a couple, you start doing this dance together of bringing up, I mean, it's what patterns brought us together, and it's patterns that are coming up together, same, very similar dynamics that are emerging.
You know, I did my first Nundro in 6 months in a 14 by 14 foot room next to my first wife. So I think you're probably right, which is, you know, is wonderful in so many ways. It's wonderful to have a Dharma friend as a mate and to practice together and all these things, but it becomes particularly important to get time alone. Because when your patterns are flashing positive, you know, when they're moving nicely, it's wonderful. When they collude actually in a particularly neurotic way, they can become particularly heavy. So this is why, particularly if we're in a relationship, we could write books and books about this from a psychological point of view, a dharmic point of view, an outer, inner, and secret point of view. But it's particularly important to find time to do some retreat, particularly if you're in a relationship. Yeah.
Okay.
It's great kindness to our partner.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, you know, because we're at one of those stages. Sorry, everybody, getting real personal here. We're at one of those stages where things are very, very rough. And I do have one day, but I'm thinking that maybe I need to do this maybe once a week for a while just to get some breathing space.
Of course. Because if we don't, and we could talk about this for hours. I'm particularly passionate about this point. But if we don't, we are going to cause a lot of trouble inadvertently or unknowingly or unconsciously as an unconscious, otherwise healthy impulse to get space. Because we long to find out, to remember who we are. And when we've been in a relationship belly to belly for so long, we lose the sense of who we are. And when we lose that, we panic and we begin to act out, not knowing this. And so I think this is particularly important. We could write a book about this. There's no end to this. Yeah.
So this is important. Thank you for your encouragement.
Yeah. John.
Hi, Tim. I was interested in your comment in your opening remarks about how in starting out meditation, there's this period of bliss or sort of a high. As I engage in this practice, Mana Mudra practice, I've had the opposite effect. You know, as I practice in this sort of this meditating on experience and realization, the patterns that come to mind are sort of the greatest lowlifes of my mind, of my life, I should say, where I, you know, sort of come to dwell on and recreate instances in my life that I wish had never happened. And, you know, I've been sort of, you know, reminded of Mingyur Rinpoche's teachings that when you encounter these kind of difficulties, you know, step away, take a moment and all that. And you know, I don't want to do that because I want to continue to engage in this practice. But then I get sort of into this wheel of, well, am I just sort of reaching for some, grasping for something? And or maybe it's just, you know, I'm up the hill, going up the hill, and sooner or at some point I'll start going down the hill when it becomes easier. So, your
so
thoughts.
John, your first point was that you begin to remember all the mistakes you've made, or?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is actually a good sign. Again, this is a good sign. My first teacher used to say the bad news is the good news, because this is a clarity. This is honesty. And we need to know how to handle this gently, so that when we begin to see our patterns and see the consequence of our patterns in our life, that what we may have done over our lives, we need to know how to handle that with care, with gentleness. But this is really important. Tulku Uchin used to say, the path is honesty and the fruition is honesty. But again, if that comes to light, we need to celebrate. Oh, this is what I've been keeping in my storehouse. You know, this is the regret, the shame, or whatever it might be. But we need to know how to handle that gently, because if we don't, we'll push it back down again. So this is why in the Vajrayana tradition, for instance, we have methods and traditions of acknowledging our sort of neurotic patterning. This is what we call sojung, or confession, the four powers of confession. So if you don't, there's much more to learn about that. But we have methods to actually deal with that stuff when we develop insight into our patterns and things we've done in the past. We have a sense of regret. We can actually purify these through acknowledgement. Yeah, this is what we refer to as confession. So even in the Buddhist tradition, we have confession. But in the Buddhist tradition, and I think also in other traditions as well, although we can't get over it, I think in the Buddhist tradition, this idea of confession has two aspects. One is an acknowledgement, and another is a quality of enthusiasm and joy that we can actually now get beyond it through this process of acknowledging. So in the end, it's quite joyful. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah. Ray.
Greetings from Boulder. I hope that the connection is good. Sometimes it's not clear. I'm really happy what you brought tonight about the fact that there are things that we leave behind at some moment. And I have come to that, like the artistic part of my life is like a previous life. And it's very interesting to look at that. The more that I've been into Dhamma, the less that I wanted to perform or be exposed or be on stage or whatsoever. I'm still a speaker, a talker. Things won't change on that side. I'm traveling now, and I'm experiencing the challenge of being behind a wheelchair in Nepal, which is not absolutely easy, and being with someone who, of course, at some point loses his boundaries and panic a little bit, which is bringing some difficult moment. I was listening to Lisa, and I was feeling very touched by what she shared, and I would like to shift to the other side. We're talking about something that we leave behind at one point because we don't feel like being in that anymore. But I am on this, I don't say on the opposite pattern, but I would say I am in a pattern in which at the moment I realize that all my Dhamma, I cannot practice the way I practice when I am at home. Now we're traveling. The situation is not easy. Today was a very, very difficult moment for both of us, especially for him. And I realized that my Dhamma was totally being there, being present, being welcoming the panic there, trying to cope with that. I'm still talking with emotion. It was very present. And I'd like you to address this part of in our path of Mahamudra, because this is being with the reality, actually. And at some point, what is practicing when your life has you to be there totally? I mean, it's the same thing for people who have children, I believe, or we have cows to milk every morning. No choice. When do you find the moment for that? I find it when I sleep and I listen to him sleeping and I go like, oh, I'm so happy that he sleeps. I don't. And then I try to meditate. I try to be just right there and to be in the feeling of being just right there. But this is like for me shifting on another side of the coin, which is, well, this is my dharma now. There's nothing else but that I can do. Being there totally, totally, fully. And I'm sure I'm practicing when I'm totally there.
I think you just answered your question, Ray.
I think I have to say that.
Yeah. Our whole life is the path.
Thank goodness. That's it. We forget it. I just feel that sometimes we forget it. When it becomes hard and the situation asks you to be there totally, we just forget that this is the practice also.
I think that there is an important difference between being a meditator and being a practitioner. It's a qualitatively different experience. So when we're a practitioner, a real yogin, then everything becomes the guru. Otherwise, we separate our life and the world from our time on the cushion. That's sort of the meditator's mind. But that's not yet really a full practitioner. I think there's quite a difference. And so at some point, you can't get away from your life and you realize your life is your path. And this is the best path you could possibly have.
It was a curious feeling today to be in this, should I say, a bad moment? It's not bad, actually. I don't find it bad. Being in Kathmandu, coming here for practices and seminar and having no seminar and no time to practice, but just being in that kind of very heavy air that you have to breathe for a moment because there's no choice. That's it. The difficulties are there. But I feel very live. I feel very joyful tonight. This is my moment of meditation, you guys. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Brian.
I want to start with just saying how thankful I am for this last teaching in this class. I've had a really bad year and my practice has been stuck. Nihilism has just become the norm because nothing seems to matter. I don't need another lesson on impermanence. I get it. I understand it. Why do I have to keep facing it anyway? But I think the real breakthrough was just a statement that triggered me, and it's being okay with not being okay. This morning, I watched this over and over again. I don't know why. You know, it's a tiny little 10-minute Mingyur video, but it for some reason it just really speaks to me. And this morning, I don't know, I was laughing. I think my son probably thinks I'm crazy, but because I had a flashback to the movie Life of Brian. And if you've ever seen this movie, at the very end, Brian is hanging on a cross singing, "Always look on the bright side of life." And it's, you know, you have to see the movie to understand it, but it's another one of those lessons I think that we're all trying to learn, is that, as Mingyur would say, you know, you have 10 experiences in life and you only look at the negative ones, you know, and you forget about the 9 that were good. So I don't know why it took me this long. I've taken several classes, but that sort of just sparked something in me. And what I came to realize is that probably the most meaningful, or what I relate to the most with all the classes I've taken, is just the Bodhisattva vow. What brings me the most joy is when I can do something meaningful for somebody else, when I can help relieve the suffering of somebody else.
Right.
And so, and that gave me great hope. I don't know why this morning it all came together, but it's like with all these different lessons coming at you from different places, but regardless of how bad it gets, the very least I can do is help the people that I encounter on a daily basis get through whatever shit they're going through. And that gives me hope. So
that's wonderful. I think that's the meaning of benefiting all beings. I think what it means is benefiting each being that you encounter. I think that's what it means to benefit all beings. That's beautiful. And that line, being okay when it's not okay, that might go down as one of Mingyur Rinpoche, yet another one of his completely quotable lines. I think it's a beautiful point. Being okay with not being okay. This is what non-meditation means, just simply being. When I heard that formulation, it really stopped me, and I've thought about it a lot since. It's been really helpful.
Thank you.
So what else? Anybody? So maybe I'll just, okay. Isaac.
Hi, Tim. I just want to go back to I asked this in our study group, but I think I'd also give it to you because when we talk about, you know, conceptual, the spectrum between conceptual understanding and realization, I just want to ask you, for example, I've done the Joy of Living. Do I have any realization? Like, you know, it's hard to me to understand a little bit where the realization lies and if we even touched it. Like, do we have seeds somewhere, or are these symbols something that we just have to wait until we get there and trust it? Or is there something like, yeah, you have seen something of it somewhere, or is it kind of still further on?
Yeah, this is a good question. You know, we can talk about realization in a number of ways, but I think the way that we can know internally is that our perception of the world changes. So, for instance, if we're thinking about and studying about compassion or the bodhisattva ideal or the bodhisattva path or, you know, whatever. So as Mingyur Rinpoche says, and as you've learned, you know, there's a hearing component, a learning component, that we learn the principles. We learn the six paramitas. We learn the logic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then as we contemplate this and as we mix it in our mind and come back to it again and again and again, from time to time, we find that we begin to act in a way that is a little more sane, a little more helpful, a little more considerate, patient, kind, generous, et cetera, et cetera. So this begins to sort of infuse our experience with just these principles. This is the experiential level. And then the realization level is that when we begin to see people in a new way, we begin, as the great Dudjom Rinpoche said, we begin to see people as only being marvelous. We see people in a different world. We see the world in a different way. This is touching on realization because it's gone so far into our system that it has changed our encounter with the world. And so I don't know if that's helpful at all. I don't think it's something that, you know, someone flips the switch and we have realization. I think it's a progressive and expanding sort of dynamic. And of course, you know, if you're going to write a treatise on the paths and the stages of the bodhisattva, you have to delineate it in all these kinds of ways. I think as a practitioner, it comes in little bursts and we know it based on how we begin to perceive the world and perceive others. That we can take to the bank. So in other words, you know, if we're wondering, oh, how's my meditation going, et cetera, et cetera. How is our relationship with our world going? That's the way to measure it. Yeah, good. So as a kind of last point, I wanted to say some things about this, but we didn't have time. But since it we've come to the end of the class, or this particular rendition of studying Mahamudra. Again, to talk about, you know, how to judge our practice. As you're saying, Isaac, we judge it by our experience of the world. And if you go through the literature and you hear from the greats, various points of conduct come up. In other words, now that we've taken this on board, how do we express it in the world? And so that we can talk, you know, you'll hear over and over again that there's a natural affinity towards good conduct, towards carefulness with our body, speech, and mind. There's a natural patience that comes along. We become less critical of the world. We're more easily contented. We're more generous. We're more naturally connected and warm-hearted. We're enthusiastic about the path. We're more relaxed and open generally. We have great appreciation for the teachings and the teachers and the lineage. I always come back to what is one of my favorite lines from the Buddha when he said about conduct, about how to be. This comes from the Metta Sutta or the Maitri Bhavana Sutra. He said, they should be able, straightforward and upright, easy to speak to, gentle and not proud, content and easily supported, with few obligations and wants, with senses calm, prudent, modest, and without greed for other people's possessions. Just as a mother would protect with her life her own child, her only child, so one should cultivate a boundless mind towards all beings and friendliness towards the entire world. So for me, if I ever wonder how to judge my practice or how to be as a practitioner, I come back to those lines, again from the Maitri Bhavana Sutra, or the Metta Sutta is called. So, as always, thank you for taking part in this. I don't know why people show up, but it's fun to just share dharmic things. And let's take a moment to imagine that if by chance anything helpful or wholesome has come up, has happened in this last hour, that we can imagine that it's multiplied infinitely and offered it, and we can offer it up to each person we see in the day, to everyone that we hear about in the news, and all beings. This is so obviously critical. This is a particularly fraught time for our world, for our human brothers and sisters, for the planet. So we can dedicate this merit. Okay, everybody. Thank you so much. Let's unmute and say goodbye.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
Tim. Thank you.
We got a team.
Thank you. See you in the next chapter.
Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.